The following talk was recorded at Libra Planet 2023, Charting the Course, an annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. Libra Planet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libraplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. Libra Planet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their uses of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take a position on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedom of all computer users, Libra Planet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join. or by making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss. For more information on Libra Planet, please visit libraplanet.org/conference.
All right. So, the name of the talk is Free Software for Non-Developers, and I think it's going to be helpful, since the theme of the conference is charting the course. I thought that we would go through some of the history of free software, because I'm later going to use this to make a point, which goes something like this. So, 1978 is the first edition Berkeley Unix. That's the first release. I'm using that as the starting point for a reason. You're going to see why. 1979, Time Bombs and Scribe. So this was sort of a pattern. There was a developer named Brian Reed at Pittsburgh who tried to sell a markup language, which was Scribe at the time. And the company that bought it refused to buy it unless they had some way of making money off it. And the way they did that was that freely downloaded versions of Scribe were set to automatically deactivate within 90 days, unless you bought a code from the company that bought out Scribe. And yeah, this is the Xerox incident, which, if you don't know, is the incident in which RMS engaged with an epic battle with a printer company over the source code for the printer. It got to the point where Xerox previously distributed the source code for their printers. Hello. Xerox previously freely distributed the source code for their printers. Eventually, they came to see it as like this trade secret, and they refused. And as a result, a lot of the optimizations that people made to the source code of the printers, they couldn't make anymore because they didn't have the source code. And they were forced to live with worse printers. And 1983, the GNU project was founded. And I bring up these other events largely in response to a lot of people started to see where software was going, that it was increasingly becoming centralized and locking out users. Yeah, and then this is for two events. The first one is the BSD lawsuit. So for those who don't know, the like 10-second version of this is AT&T had basically become incredibly litigious and just decided to sue Berkeley Software Distribution Incorporated, which originally had the license from UC Berkeley. And I actually read the whole case on the way here. It's very boring. But the short version is, and there's all sorts of things where like they had to include the university because the university licensed it, but the university is technically a state entity, which means they're exempt from certain lawsuits. This is a whole thing. But then you have the release of the Linux kernel, which was licensed out of the GPL. And those two events are not unrelated. I believe Linus Torvalds said in the past that part of the reason he was seeking to develop the Linux kernel was because of the BSD lawsuit. There was very much a fear that the last of free software, so Unix had been acquired by this point, and BSD had been really the last major free software project up until that point, apart from GNU, which was founded specifically in response to that. And yeah, and I bring all this up So we can sort of take stock of what's happened so far. So what, since 1992, when the Linux kernel was developed, and the rest is history, what has the free software movement accomplished? What has it done well? So some of the things it's done well, designing really good software. So here are a few examples. And I'm having fun with the animations. Yeah, so these are just a couple of examples. The one on the top right is Blender. Blender, if you don't know, is a 3D graphics engine. It's actually used in industry quite a lot. Stockfish is this fish thing in the middle there. That is a chess engine that actually, it was really funny. It beat all of the commercial chess engines, and it was better than everybody else for a very long time. Now there's another one, which, by the way, is also free software, called Alpha. What is it, Alpha Zero, if anybody knows. But yeah, and then the third one obviously is GTK, which is also used in a lot of commercial products. And often it beats proprietary competitors. And the second thing, I think this is something that's often overlooked, that there's an entire free software ecosystem that depends on other free software. And I used an example here, sort of off the screen. But that's apt, which is under the GPL2, which depends on DPKG, which depends on core utils, which depends on libacl, which depends on libadder1, et cetera. And these are all free software. And so you can build software on top of software on top of software. And all of it's free and it's great. Okay, now, what has the free software movement done less well? We have to look at the graph. And yes, I mean the graph, which is this one. Desktop operating system, and if I was wondering this myself, which is how did they get this information? The answer is it's from browser visits. So a number of people collect data about what browsers visit particular websites, and this is based on page views, essentially, and it excludes mobile operating systems like iOS and Android. And you will notice Windows is the blue line at the top, and then Mac OS is the pink one. And you might think this has gotten better over time. No, it hasn't. Yeah, no, it has not gotten better over time. The decline of Windows was largely replaced by the pink line. I have yet to figure out what unknown is. My guess is, like, if anyone knows what happened round about mid-2018 that would have caused internet companies to be unable to identify the browser, like, I don't know, was Edge released then? I wasn't sure, but it's not really the point. The point is, in terms of personal desktops, free software has done pretty bad. Like, this has not gone especially well in terms of getting people to adopt free software alternatives in their everyday lives. And I think part of the reason, you can figure this out by looking at the timeline. So I'm going to continue this timeline from before to illustrate a point. So it wasn't until 1997 that most American households owned a computer. It wasn't until 2003 that more than half of them had internet access. And this was very surprising to me. You can let them in. That 10% of American households still don't have internet access. And I think this is sort of indicative of a particular problem, which is that society has evolved since the free software movement was founded and the things it responded to were relevant. But I'm concerned that the way we talk about free software hasn't. And I'm gonna probably suggest some alternatives and some ways we can make this relevant to people who are not really developers. So here, you will. I brought up the four freedoms. I've abbreviated them so they'll fit in one line, but they're broadly accurate. I got them from the FSF website. One of the things I think is important to remember is when the GNU project was originally founded, most people who use software also developed it, and that is absolutely not the case anymore, right? So when you look at these two freedoms here, the freedom to study how the program works and the freedom to distribute modified copies to others. If I'm somebody who doesn't really know what source code is or care, it's going to be really difficult for me to see why those two things are important to me. I will say that the other two freedoms, the freedom to run the program for any purpose and the freedom to redistribute exact copies, those are freedoms that I think a lot of people who don't develop software can get behind. That's sort of pretty obvious. However, there is actually a type of program that you can run for any purpose and you can redistribute exact copies and the developers will be thrilled with you if you do that. It's called a computer virus. And that's part of the reason I wanted to talk about this, because these other two freedoms are actually quite important, even for people who don't develop software themselves. And part of the goal of this talk is to try to basically convey to people who don't want to do these things themselves why it is important to them personally that other people be allowed to study how the program works and to redistribute modified copies. And before I get into that, I do want to talk about some of the ways that people have tried to get people who are not that into software into free software and why I think they're a bit misguided.
Thank you.
So this is a common one, is that, well, there's a lot of people who don't know about software, and it's only people who are very familiar with software who care about these things. Obviously, education is the answer, right? Because if we can just get ordinary people to learn more about how software works, we should, you know, teach computer science to elementary school kids, that sort of thing. If we just do that and everyone knows about their computers, we can create a great free software environment where ordinary people are cognizant of these freedoms. And here's the thing, that's not a bad thing. None of that stuff is bad. I'm not disagreeing with any of that, but I don't think that's reasonable. Like, and what I mean by that is I don't think it's reasonable to ask that of people, right? Honestly, I think most of us use technology that we don't really understand how it works. Like, I could explain vaguely to you how a combustion engine works. I know it involves pistons, and you have to burn gasoline. But then when you ask me about an electric engine, I can't even do that. I have no idea how it works. And the important point here is I shouldn't have to. And I don't think that it's really fair to ask people to learn the intricacies of their computers, when in reality, most people just use computers because they're trying to do something else. So my example is my dad, when he got his first computer in the early 90s, the only reason he got it was because his office had stopped using typewriters, because it turns out when you have a typewriter, you have to keep a manuscript, and a lot of bad things can happen to the manuscript. And you can go to the copier to copy it, but then a lot of bad things can happen when you're on your way to the copier. And with software, you could just, back then, you could store it on a floppy, and then there, you're saved. You don't have to worry about it, and you can back it up on the hard drive, on the floppy, and there's no problem. But my point is he only switched to that because circumstances made him do that. And I think that's how most people who aren't developers themselves use software. They use it to accomplish something. They need it for a task, and they don't particularly care very much about the intricacies of how it works. They want somebody else to deal with that. And, oopsie, I think that's okay. I think you shouldn't necessarily require that people be interested in something that they're just not interested in. People have jobs that are very important that have nothing to do with software, that are actually where their interests lie. And they should be allowed to do that. And then the second approach, which I think is, again, well-intentioned, but perhaps a bit misguided, is that everyone should care about free software because they should care about privacy. So I like privacy. Privacy's great. I don't dispute that at all. There's a couple of problems with that. So the first one is that it is theoretically possible that non-free software can respect your privacy, although I understand that that is a bit difficult to conceive of. Like, just imagine that, you know, RMS or the EFF or somebody like that signed an NDA that specifically said they're allowed to they're allowed to disclose information about the software if and only if it violates your privacy. And then they came out and said, yep, it completely respects your privacy, no problem. That's at least theoretically possible. And then the one that's a bit easier to imagine is that free software does not necessarily respect your privacy. So it is entirely possible for there to be a free software project that says, yes, we are doing all of this telemetry on you, we're spying on you, we're making money off it, we're sending all of this to Amazon, and we're making tons of, oh, how'd that get in there? So what do I think is the right way to do this? Like, what's the correct way to talk about this? So one approach you could take, which is correct, is that you could talk about all the sorts of practical reasons why people should care. It leads to better security, for example, because people will catch security flaws if everybody has an opportunity to see it. The code quality is better if other people can review it. And if you care about those sorts of things, you can go and have a very lovely conversation with the FreeBSD people who will tell you all sorts of things about why open source projects are more efficient than proprietary ones. I'm not primarily interested in that. My concern is the ethical reasons. So I'm going to try this. Quick show of hands, if we can. If we exclude firmware and device drivers, I'm curious how many people here have at least one free system that they run. Anyone? Okay, so we do have a few people. Okay, now, raise your hands of those people if and only if you have personally read all of the available source code installed on that device. Whoa, you have? If you have LibreOffice installed, you're lying. Okay. That's impressive. Most people don't do that, right? Because it's very difficult to have a functioning system and read all the source code. There's too much of it. And I bring this up only because that means that when you run a developer's code, you are placing a great deal of trust in that developer. If you run a distribution, and the distribution has repositories, you're placing a lot of trust in the maintainers of that distribution and the maintainers of those repositories that even if they haven't reviewed the code, they've got it from a reputable source, and they're not just putting random garbage in the repositories. And as a result, as a developer, you have a responsibility not to abuse the trust that people place in you, right? So to some extent, you have an obligation to make some kind of effort that malicious stuff doesn't get into your repos or that you're not going to exploit somebody who trusts you with part of their system or to perform some particular task. And this is sort of the point that I want to emphasize, and that's why it's in bold. Providing the source code is a demonstration of good faith on the developer's part that they're not going to take advantage of people who are dependent on them. And the way that you know that is that if the developer tries to do that, you can always go to someone else, right? Projects get forked all the time. And even if the project doesn't get forked, you could always hire somebody to maintain the project for you. And I think one of the problems with source code that is not, like when you don't distribute the source code, is you don't give users the ability to do that, right? They are entirely dependent on you to maintain it, to ensure that nothing malicious is put in there, that you won't exploit them for your own purposes. And as a developer, provision of source code is essentially saying, here's this proof that I can exploit you in some way, that I won't abuse your trust, because if I try, or if you find out that something has gone wrong, you can always find somebody else to fix it. And I thought of this analogy. And a friend of mine said, That's just a point I wanted to make, that if someone is not being transparent about what they're giving to you, you should be incredibly suspicious. And I'm going to make this point a little bit in the next slide. So I thought of this analogy. And I mentioned it to a friend of mine when I was preparing for this talk. And he said, someone has almost certainly come up with that because that's too good. and you should look around the internet for that. And he was right, somebody did. And this is an article, which is on the FSF website. It's called Car Analogy, which was written by Tal Schlechter, who was one of the interns of the FSF way back in 2009. And the basic premise of the article is, suppose you go to the dealership to buy a new car and your new car has a trunk, CD player, digital radio, but these don't work because you didn't pay enough money. You'll always call the car company with your credit card details and unlock these later. If you wanted to have your car fixed, you would go to an accredited licensed repair shop. It would be illegal for anyone else to open the hood. When you get to your licensed repair shop, they would charge you an accredited repair license surcharge. And my only problem with this analogy is it didn't go far enough, so I added my own. The engine requires a cryptographic key from one of our engineers to unlock, and it totally does not have a tendency to randomly explode. All these people who work for us and signed NDA say so, and if they ever tell anyone what's in there, we'll sue them into the ground. Yeah. Yeah, so about that, this happened. Oh, it's off the screen. It's on the slide, I swear. But anyway, it's a headline from the BBC that says, BMW introduces new heated seat subscription in the UK. The features are available via BMW's Connected Drive online store and are activated remotely. No need to visit a dealer. And then the next one's really cheeky. The company argues that the ability to add new features can be helpful for owners who change their minds after purchase. And it's particularly useful for secondhand car owners, now that they have the opportunity to add features the original owner didn't choose. And then this one, I just want to draw your attention to the second sentence. The hardware is already there. Drivers will merely have to pay an extra fee to activate them through an over-the-air software upgrade on BMW's Connected Drive platform. And that's where they can pay for other features locked behind an annual subscription, including camera safety alerts and wait a minute. Safety camera alerts? You're paying? Anyway, my point is, oh yeah, and this happened a week before I was gonna give this talk. Ford can remotely repossess your cars. They filed a patent. Anyway, it doesn't matter. My point is, everyone agrees this is wrong, pretty much, except the companies, I guess. But the question is why? And that's where I think this analogy has some power when it comes to free software. So the first reason why it's wrong is related to the trust issue I was talking about before. In the car thing, it creates dependency on the seller after the transaction is over and invites the seller to insert themselves into your life significantly down the line. Right? You're basically, as somebody who's distributing the car or the software, you're setting it up so that that person is essentially going to go back to you no matter what, and they don't really have a choice. Apple is sort of infamous for doing this. They make it extraordinarily difficult for you to change from an iPhone to something else because all of your data is on iCloud, and you'll lose your Apple Music subscription. They essentially try to put up very large walls, and it's not like you can just fork iOS and make a freely distributed version. And the second thing, it deliberately makes the product worse. So Microsoft sells two versions of Microsoft Office. One is Microsoft Office Home, and the other one is Microsoft Office Pro. And the only difference is Microsoft Office Home is Pro that they've taken a bunch of stuff out of and charged you less for. It doesn't cost them anything to distribute these, mind you. It only costs them things to develop it, but the Pro is already there. They're just downgrading it for you. And then thirdly, this is a point that I'm going to come back to. Computers are increasingly personal devices. So maybe 30, 40 years ago, free software would have seemed like something very weird and esoteric to a lot of people because most people didn't own a computer. Most people didn't even own embedded systems. My dad had a pop-up toaster instead of the electric ones. And I bring this up just because as more and more people adopt software, things that you might be able to tolerate in a business context and that don't seem terribly important to you suddenly feel as if they're encroaching on your personal life in a way that feels incredibly intrusive and creepy. I'm going to come back to that. Yeah, so this is a common thing that I've heard people say, is they say, well, you know, when you pay for Microsoft Office, Microsoft gives you the product, you're consenting to that transaction, right? So you're coming in here randomly as a third party and saying, well, you don't get to consent to that transaction, so doesn't that make it morally acceptable? No. So why not? That's my main point. What people are willing to accept as acceptable is going to set the standard for what is acceptable. So yes, it's true that in a vacuum, if you and Microsoft are the only people doing business, then sure, it is true that both of you consented to the transaction. But this is a broader thing than that. This is something that will set the standard for what is even in people's imagination. So a lot of people, actually, I'm actually a law student. I'm not a developer professionally, and I worked at a prosecutor's office over the summer. By the way, scary thing, this was summer of 2022, all the computers were running Windows Vista. Yeah, exactly. And I remember talking to my supervisor, and he saw, I was actually using Gentoo, so he saw like a bunch of scrolling text and he got scared. And he's like, what is that? And I had to like explain to him what free software was, and I talked about LibreOffice, and I said, you know, there's like free software alternatives to all these things you use. And he said, but if it's free, why isn't everybody using it? Yeah, exactly. That's the point. When this becomes normal, when this becomes the standard, and this is just the way people interact with software, it limits the imagination about what is possible, right? And I would argue that because you're setting the standard for what is acceptable in this domain of software and how we interact with it and how we interact with developers, that's really the issue here. What is standard? What is normal? What is expected on a societal level from developers and users? And I think this is important. Even though the user is doing something that I would argue is not a good thing, or is even morally wrong, it's primarily the distributor's fault. It's the transaction that's the problem. It's not necessarily the person. So I mean, if you want some kind of analogy, it was really common in the 19th century for very large companies to have like company towns, where basically everything was owned by the corporation. You got paid in company dollars that you could only spend at the company store, and you couldn't spend them anywhere else. So you essentially had people trapped in these towns that were entirely controlled by the company, and they couldn't leave. That's bad. That is very wrong. However, the blame doesn't really lie with the worker here. The problem is the whole system, the way that this business is done. And you could make the same consent argument, actually. You say, well, you know, technically they're consenting. Okay, fine. Yeah. I think that the way to frame this, really, if you want to talk about this with people, is that it is an unethical business practice. You could also, if you're dealing with somebody who's a bit more stingy, you could basically say that this business is trying to lock you into their product so you can't find competitors. That's another, I don't really like that way of putting it, but if it works, do it. That was mostly my presentation. I wanted to summarize the points. Oh, I forgot this slide. Yeah. This graph. So I showed this at the beginning of presentation. Half of you weren't here, so I'll show it again. That top line, again, is Windows. That one, the pink line below, is Mac OS. This is based on page views. And I say there's an opportunity here because you'll notice that all of these are like personal computers, right? There's not a lot of there's not a lot of RHEL or SUSE Enterprise or stuff like that. It's just all things that people mostly use. They don't necessarily solely use it as personal computers, but I would say for most people, that's the sort of computer they're very familiar with. And that sort of brings me back to the point I wanted to talk about earlier, which is how personal computers have become and how personal software is, which is as people increasingly adopt operating systems like Windows or Mac OS and stuff like that, a lot of their lives are on their computers. It's everything from, you know, their WhatsApp messages, their text messages, their videos, their Instagram photos, I don't know. And I think as that happens, restrictions on that software or an inability to control that software feels increasingly intrusive and creepy. And the reason I say there's an opportunity here is because that's something that we didn't have 10, 20, well, maybe 10 years ago, but not 20 or 30 years ago. And I think that's something that we should capitalize on in explaining this to people who are not developers, is that that's how they interact with software. And the fact that they're increasingly interacting with software in that way is going to lead a lot of people to be a lot more sympathetic to that point. So, roughly to summarize, provision of source code is a sign from a developer of good faith. It is a sign that you're not going to be exploited by someone else. Lack of transparency on their part should make you very suspicious of their motivations. Is this person trying to lock me into a product? Is this person trying to get my money? Is this person trying to do something malicious, even? And then the final point, you shouldn't be dependent on a specific person or a specific company in order to fix your software. I don't know why that point doesn't really fit with the others. Apologies. This is sort of the bottom line. If you take anything away from this, I will say you should take this away. You should frame non-disclosure of source code as an unethical business practice that companies take part in. The reason that non-developers should care about free software is fundamentally because it actually does limit their freedom as users of the software and opens them up to being exploited by companies that don't disclose their source code. And fundamentally, even if they're not worried about being exploited in that way, other people do face that risk. And that's ultimately why I think that unethical business practice is a phrase that should come up a bit more often in those discussions. These are all the citations. The US Census there was where I got the internet data. And yeah, those are the news articles I used. And yeah, I think, do I have time for questions? Yes, no. I do. Okay. Yes.
I work at a university, and I have fights with the director of IT all the time about using free software. They're using these proprietary things that don't quite do what we need. And I've always said, why don't you hire a developer who will make exactly what we need and use the software, and it will be free. We just have to pay the developer. And he said, if something goes wrong, I need this to be backed up by a company because I can pick up the phone and call someone who will fix it. So this is about your point. You shouldn't be dependent on a person. But he's a nice person. He's not a developer. He will lose his job if something catastrophic happens on the campus and he can't fix it. And so he says, if we hire a developer, that person might move to California. We can't count on them to come and fix the software they wrote for us. What do you say about that person? He's not being malicious. He's just saying, I lose my job if I can't pick up the phone and call somebody. It's theoretically true that you don't need to be dependent on anyone because you can always get another developer to do your project. But forking it, finding a developer, none of that is in the workplace schema for this person who has a job who's supposed to make sure that everything keeps working.
That's a fair point. I think probably my instinct would be to say that there are actually companies that distribute free software that do that, right? So SUSE is just one example, Red Hat's another. I don't want to bring up Canonical, but, and yeah, you're right, that to some extent somebody who's in a position like that is going to have to be dependent on someone, but, right, you have to be able to pick up the phone, call a company if you can't do it yourself. But what I would say is if you do that if you do that with a company that has proprietary software, you're making yourself doubly dependent, in a sense, because if you're dependent on SUSE to fix something, you're only dependent on SUSE to fix something because typically the source code in their repositories is free software. I believe they distribute some kinds of like non-free device drivers, but typically when you're talking about a very serious IT problem, that's not what you're talking about. And I think to answer your question about what you could say to that person, there are free software companies you can hire to do that sort of thing. And I think you're always going to be dependent on them to some extent, but I think the reasons you're dependent on them aren't to do with free software, it's more to do with the position that the IT guy finds himself in, if that makes any sense. I hope that answered your question. That's true, but like, that's true, but Red Hat will not provide you with support for things that they don't maintain. That's what I would say the main problem is. Like, they'll say, okay, install Red Hat on all your computers, and then we'll help you. Yeah. Yeah.
One more time, sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. You can talk to me afterwards. Yeah.